Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show,
push GPs, I think, to recognise symptom complexes as being related to endometriosis.
New study shows endometriosis diagnoses have doubled in Australia.
In the last census, you had over 1 million homes, around about 10% of all private dwellings were unoccupied.
Experts urge stronger government action to expand social housing and affordability. And later today...
And in the hospital environment, at the best of times, it can get very lonely and boring, and you've got a lot of time to think about your mortality.
New virtual reality program helps hospital patients escape through immersive travel experiences. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. A new Monash University study has found that endometriosis diagnoses in Australian general practice have nearly doubled between 2011 to 2021. I spoke with lead author, Professor Daniela Maza, about what's driving this increase and how upcoming initiatives aim to improve diagnosis and care for women.
We saw almost a doubling of endometriosis diagnosis from 2011 to 2021. And during that time, I think there's been a lot more community awareness about endometriosis by consumer groups. And there's also been increased awareness amongst GPs through the development of national guidelines and other educational activities that has really pushed GPs, I think, to recognise symptom complexes as being related to endometriosis and order the investigations that will help to diagnose this complex and chronic condition.
The study found it takes about 2.5 years to, you know, get that diagnosis. How can GPs, shorten that delay?
Yeah, so that was the median time to diagnosis. So there were some women where it was shorter and some women where it was much higher. GPs are being encouraged through new guidelines that have been issued on endometriosis to use pelvic ultrasound more as a diagnostic tool for endometriosis. So happily, the study also found that GPs are ordering many more of these ultrasounds in women with these symptoms, and that can help make the diagnosis earlier and mean that women don't need to wait on waiting lists for a laparoscopy, which was previously considered the only way to diagnose endometriosis. Mm-hmm. So I think earlier use of ultrasound to help clarify the picture, but also, women are presenting with symptoms of heavy periods, period pain, pelvic pain, and we know that products like hormonal products like the pill or hormonal IUDs or implants can be very effective at managing these symptoms. So the guidelines are also encouraging GPs to consider the diagnosis of endometriosis and start treating the symptoms with these products in the hope that the earlier management of the symptoms will lead to better outcomes for women.
How will the new endometriosis management plan help GPs better care for women with the condition?
So endometriosis is a chronic condition. When you have it, it doesn't go away, but we can treat the symptoms and help women a lot. So this management plan is trying to utilise systems of care like chronic disease management planning to put in place a guide that answers women's needs and also institutes evidence-based guideline recommendations. So it's a structured process that a woman goes through at a general practice, either with one of the practice nurses and GPs together or with a GP on their own. And it helps to identify what the needs of the woman are in relation to her endometriosis and how best to manage them. And it documents that and also helps women to access the five subsidised visits to an allied health professional that the government offers for people with chronic conditions.
What more can GPs and specialists do to give women better healthcare moving forward?
We need to listen to women and the symptoms that they have and consider that endometriosis is a very common condition in our community. About 14% of women have a diagnosis of endometriosis by the time they reach 49. So it's a very common condition. And if women are presenting with heavy periods or with very bad period pain or with pelvic pain or fatigue or a mixture of those kind of symptoms, to really have in the back of our mind that this could be endometriosis, Get a pelvic ultrasound done and start treatment to help women to get those better outcomes.
That was lead author Professor Danielle Maza speaking to The Wire. Housing experts are calling on federal and state governments to make real commitments to increase social housing supply to tackle the national housing crisis. The federal government established the $10 billion Housing Australia Future Fund in 2023 to provide at least $500 million for social and affordable housing projects every year. But Professor Alan Morris from the University of Technology Sydney says this isn't going far enough to get low-income Australians into secure housing. Political reporter Noah Saccombe spoke with Professor Morris about why social housing is so important to address the broader housing crisis.
We're always talking about how hard it is to own a home. Is 100% home ownership the actual end goal when we're talking about fixing housing?
No, not necessarily. I mean, in many countries, private renting is quite common and is accepted. It's not stigmatized at all. And a lot of people are lifelong private renters, you know, countries like Switzerland, Germany to some extent. And of course, in many countries, social housing plays a very major role. Countries like Austria, for example, Singapore has this massive social housing sector. So home ownership is not necessarily the end point. I mean, obviously, in a country like Australia, I mean, if you're a homeowner, it is advantageous. And I mean, what it does do, obviously, it gives you an asset, which unfortunately is appreciating all the time. And that's good for you if you're a homeowner, but it obviously is not very good if you're not a homeowner. It enables people to, once they retire, if they are homeowners, they have low housing costs, which enables them to live on comfortably on the age pension. Well, you know, frugal but comfortable. They can sell their home, they can leave it to their children, etc. So certainly home ownership does have advantages, but it's 100% home ownership is not necessarily essential. Within the ranks of the homeowners, you have people with more than one home, you know, investors, holiday homes. In the last census, you had over 1 million homes, around about 10% of all private dwellings were unoccupied, which is quite remarkable. So we're not exactly sure what was going on there, but it is a puzzle.
Does that mean that the issue is purely a supply problem?
No, definitely not. You know, there have been periods where prices have dropped, where there's been plenty of supply and there hasn't been all that much building, et cetera. So one has to look at the whole housing sector holistically. I mean, obviously supply is important. If there's a drastic shortage of housing, then there's a problem. But I don't think there's a drastic shortage. Airbnb, for example, takes up a lot of dwellings which could be on the market. The bigger issue in Australia is the whole financialization of housing. I mean, what has happened in Australia over the last three decades is that housing's become this very, very important sector for investment. 20% of Australian taxpayers, over 20%, own an investment property. And that is certainly driving up prices. There's no doubt about it. You talk to any person trying to enter the market, they go to an auction and they're outbid by an investor. That is a massive issue.
What is the importance of having affordable and social housing in the mix in places close to jobs?
It's essential. If you want to talk about a just city is a city which has affordable housing, which has social mix, which isn't totally fragmented. You know, what we have is a situation now where we have enormous intensification of spatial divide, basically, based on class and income. If you're low income, the only way you can enter the housing market, if you want to enter the housing market, is to live far away from employment. And even to rent, you have to rent far away. This is creating enormous problems. You know, it's putting a lot of pressure on many households. I think even something like domestic violence, I mean, it's very difficult to have any direct correlation, but I wouldn't be surprised that a lot of the stress. Domestic violence seems to be a bit of an epidemic. I mean, it seems to be becoming very pervasive, but I think it's a lot of it is due to this financial stress, people having to travel vast distances. You know, it's like the home becomes the only area where it's like a male can control, you know. Maybe that's drawing a long bow, but I do feel that this whole housing crisis is having a range of unintended consequences. So what social and affordable housing does, if it's decent social housing, affordable housing, and well located, it gives people the opportunity to, in a sense, not worry persistently about housing costs. I mean, the other very important impact of this housing crisis is, I think, mental health. It's having an enormous impact on people's mental health, a lot of anxiety. I have interviewed a lot of private renters, low-income private renters, and there's persistent anxiety. You know, they are constantly worried about what will happen tomorrow. Will the rent be put up? You know, will the landlord say they're selling the property, etc.? You know, I've interviewed older private renters on the age pension who've said to me, well, what's the point of going on? Their lives are so hard. Whereas their counterparts in social housing, you know, older people who've retired on the age pension, they're able to live a decent life. They're able to, you know, because the rent is predictable, as long as they don't smoke too much, drink too much, or gamble too much, they're able to save, they're able to go on holiday, they're able to eat adequately. The age pension is reasonable if your housing costs are low. So I think housing is really the elephant in the room. If we can bolster the proportion of housing, which is social housing and affordable housing, I think society will be really improved overall. You know, it will have a lot of positive spin-offs.
And you can catch more of the interview with Professor Morris and others talking about the housing crisis in the next episode of From Pillar to Post tomorrow. You're listening to The Wire on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amini Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM. And to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3. And to the other side of the country to Radio Goolari in Broome, Western Australia. Around 40% of young people across Australia aged 16 to 24 have experienced multiple types of childhood maltreatment. And new research from the Australian Catholic University shows these experiences are linked to higher rates of problematic alcohol use. With young people who experience multiple forms of maltreatment having a 55% higher risk compared to those who don't. The Wire's Tia Bailey spoke with a PhD candidate and leading researcher, Datsayini Ratambije, why understanding the broader context of a young person's life are essential when developing effective support programs.
Your collaborative research shows that young people who go through different types of childhood abuse are much more likely to develop problematic alcohol use. What sparked the need for this study?
So we know in Australia from the Australian Child Maltreatment Study that many young people and also adults experience maltreatment. So the reason we were interested in looking at this subset of population, the youth population, was because young people are more exposed to social interactions and events where they can be using substances. And we really wanted to understand how adversities contribute to this risk. There is obviously a lot of reasons for why young people drink, but this study specifically looks at how experiencing maltreatment or experiencing any form of adversity during childhood lead to problematic alcohol use.
Can you explain why some experiences like sexual abuse present to carry higher risk?
If someone's experiencing or experienced sexual abuse, they're more likely to consume alcohol for coping from that trauma. And they're also more likely to have, we say, internalizing symptoms. So this is a diagnosis of PTSD or anxiety or depression. And they're also more likely to have externalizing symptoms, which really means the possibility of having risk-taking behaviors, such as consuming alcohol problematically.
Could you also please further explain how the study revealed that it is the duration of the maltreatment that is directly associated with alcohol outcomes, as opposed to age of onset of the abuse?
It is a very nuanced finding because one of our key findings in this study was that experiencing multiple forms of maltreatment was the greatest and strongest association to problematic alcohol use. So obviously, if you're experiencing multiple forms of maltreatment, then you're also likely to experience it for longer periods of time. And therefore, duration had this unique significant effect on problematic alcohol use. There is obviously a need to do further research to explore that finding more. We would prefer to do it using a longitudinal data set where we can follow young people over time and monitor their behaviors and mental health issues that may develop in them to understand how and when does duration matter the most.
In terms of the outcomes, how do you see the findings of the research reshaping or contribute to the development of support programs that best work for young people who have been through these experiences?
There is plenty of research in this field, but what is unique about this work is that we didn't just look at maltreatment types or household adversities, we looked at them all. So adversities where the child has been put in a situation directly by their caretaker or parents, or even adversities within the environment that they live in. So living with someone who had substance use or mental health issues, but also witnessing or being a victim in neighborhood violence, right? So what this research actually contributes is to show that when we are encountering a young person with problematic alcohol use, or they're coming into clinical work, or if you're a social worker working with them, it's important to not just address their behavior of problematic alcohol use, but also to consider the environment in which they live in. It could be their direct houses, their parents, their families, or it could be their neighborhood and their peers. Who are they engaging with? What is the environment in which they live in? So, because oftentimes in clinical spaces, or whether they're a social worker or even us researchers, we tend to work independently rather than together as a unit. So it's important to bring all of this together and look at this young person, not just for their behavior and for their immediate abuse that they've experienced, but look at them as a unit, as a family unit, as a community.
That was leading researcher Dutsani Ratambije speaking to The Wire's Tia Bailey. For many long-term hospital patients, days can blend into weeks with little connection to the outside world. However, one charity called the Chimera Legacy Foundation is helping patients take a break without having to leave the hospital. After surviving leukemia and a lung transplant himself, Damien Thompson, originator of the Chimeria Legacy Foundation, created Holiday from Hospital, a virtual reality initiative that transports patients to beaches, forests, and far-off cities, all through a headset. Reporter Ella Panzolo spoke with Damien Thompson to find out about the Holiday from Hospital program and its expansion into Australian locations.
Initially, because I was diagnosed at the age of 23 with an aggressive form of leukemia, I had to have a bone marrow transplant. And coming from Townsville, that meant at the time I had to go to Brisbane. And so I spent my time down there having chemotherapy and radiation. With a successful bone marrow transplant, however, I suffered a disease from the bone marrow transplant, autoimmune disease called graft versus host disease. And so over the years, had slowly eaten away my lungs is probably the better word for it. And so I needed a double lung transplant. And during that time, I spent a lot of hours in isolation, just in one room. And in the hospital environment, at the best of times, it can get very lonely and boring and feel a lot of time to think about your mortality, given that I was in a bad situation. It just sort of brought on a lot of anxiety and insomnia. So I was not successfully treated for that with the mainstream medications that I was given. So I looked for alternative therapies and I come across virtual reality. And after using the virtual reality headset the first time, I was able to get a good solid 6 hours sleep. So from that point, I set my mind on how can I provide this to as many other patients as possible, given that it really significantly improved my recoveries. So I started Chimeria Legacy Foundation and I started workshopping different virtual reality programs to better understand other patients' experience, not just my own. And that's where Holiday from Hospital was born.
How does the virtual reality experience work and what kind of places can patients visit?
Well, it's a very powerful tool in that you're not just seeing something as though you are on the TV. You're putting a goggles on over your face, essentially, over your eyes, and you're immersing yourself in that environment. So if you can imagine being there, that is what virtual reality is. And so it's my goal to provide all of the locations or as many locations around the world in which we have. What we don't have is locations around Australia, and Australia is a beautiful part of the world. And so I've started on a new initiative called the Great Australian Outback Tour, in which I go and around to these beautiful and remote locations, and I film in virtual reality all of this, the beautiful gorges, the natural springs, the beaches, any nice hidden remote parts of Australia. And then I include that into the Holiday from Hospital program so that patients can travel right from their bedside and essentially have a holiday from hospital.
How do you plan on expanding this program?
Well, the first answer to that is community support. It's important to state that nobody is being paid for this, the expansion of this. Every donation goes towards the software and the equipment and obviously the travel to expand the Holiday from Hospital program. Now, directly, we want to work with hospital foundations because they have an obligation to initiate or adopt new patient-centric programs that improve the mental well-being for their patients. And this being the most popular one, we hope to, as I said, partner with those guys so that we can equip every hospital throughout Australia, which is not a big ask, so that the technology is at least accessible to everybody within the hospital, that they can provide a holiday from hospital to their patients. Who wouldn't want to do that? It's easy to take a break from work and organise a little trip away somewhere so that you can mentally reset. But unfortunately for patients, especially the guys that are having life-saving treatments, they're not afforded that ability. And I strongly encourage all hospital foundations to reach out to me and work with us to equip their hospitals so that this holiday from hospital is accessible to all of their patients. It's a beautiful thing. It really impacts the patients in a very positive way, and it's so beneficial to their mental well-being. And it's just such a small thing in the theme of things. So That would be my message.
That was Damien Thompson speaking to The Wire. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations, 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ, and Radio 4EB in Brisbane, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, Instagram, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced, and we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakur, coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.